Cosmic Shed. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Shed. Today's episode is all about Lost in Space. I'm Andrew and with me today is...
Ty. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really good. It's been sunny today and we're sat in your shed.
Have you been enjoying Lost in Space?
I have been loving Lost in Space. Me and my wife have watched the first three episodes. We're on board. I want to get out of here so I can go home and watch some more.
Okay, cool. Well, let's do that. We're going to talk to Professor Ethan Siegel, who first joined us for our episode on Star Trek Discovery. And he's going to tell us all about Lost in Space, his thoughts on that, and the Drake Equation, life in the universe, Big Bang Theory, all that sort of stuff. But Ty, before all that, tell us about Lost in Space.
Ah, Lost in Space. Okay, so Lost in Space was the brainchild of Irwin Allen, who was a film and TV producer who was known as the Master of Disaster. So you've probably seen a couple of films that he produced. The Poseidon Adventure. So big cruise liner gets flipped upside down. Survivors have to get out. Towering Inferno. Big tower gets set on fire. Survivors have to get out. And I think he did the Fantastic Voyage. I think he...
Really?
Yeah. Okay. So, scientist gets ill. Scientists have to get injected into him to remove blood clot. Save the day. He also produced a whole bunch of great TV shows. Lost in Space is probably the most famous, but it wasn't the one that I watched as a kid that much. I saw a couple of episodes when I was younger, and because it's the Swiss Family Robinson in space... That's why they're called the Robinsons. You know, the concept's very easy to get on board with. But the shows that he produced that I used to watch on Channel 4 was Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, which was the Sequest DSV of its time. Used to love that show. And also Land of the Giants.
Oh, yeah.
Which was kind of like a Lost in Space, but it was this crew that went through like a wormhole and ended up in essentially 1970s America, where everyone's just a giant.
Yeah.
And he also produced Time Tunnel, which I never really watched. But Lost in Space was a very popular TV show during the 60s. It was a peer of Star Trek. Like Star Trek, it only ran for three seasons. And you actually never found out what happened to the Robinsons in the original 60s show. Like Sam Beckett in Quantum Leap, they keep travelling through the universe trying to get home. But it was a very, like I said, Swiss Family Robinson dynamic. It's like a pitch-perfect white family. John and Maureen Robinson and the three kids, Judy, Penny and Will. You have Major Don West, who's the pilot. You have Dr. Smith, who is the saboteur that sabotaged their mission, making them go through hyperspace and getting lost in space. And, of course, the robot. It was very popular. And, of course, in 1998, Hollywood tried to make a big-budget film version of this with William Hurt, Gary Oldman and Matt LeBlanc as Don West.
It wasn't good, right?
It wasn't good. Not many people liked it. It was weirdly dark and at the same time quite childish. It was also actually the year before The Phantom Menace, and it has to be said that it's actually responsible for one of the first CGI creations before Jar Jar Binks, because Matt LeBlanc finds like a big CGI monkey that plays with him throughout.
Yeah.
But the robot was cool. An Apollo 440's remix of John Williams' classic Lost in Space theme was great. A TV series tried to get off the ground in 2003. John Woo produced it. Hong Kong action legend John Woo. He directed the pilot. I think Adrian Palicki, from John Wick and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., she was one of the daughters in it. I can't remember who else was in it. It never made it past the pilot. Anyway, no one really saw it. There are a couple of publicity photos online. The most famous thing about that show was the sets were actually reused for Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, cool.
The Jupiter 2 sets were essentially repurposed and turned into the Battlestar Pegasus. Because that was... they were moving into Season 2 at about that time. So, finally, we've got round to Lost in Space being rebooted again. Netflix have thrown so much money at this. It looks great. And they've got a hell of a cast in there. Parker Posey is the new Dr. Smith. Toby Stevens, son of Dame Maggie Smith, is John Robinson. And then you've just got a host of very familiar faces from shows like House of Cards, Homeland just sprinkled in throughout. And it's really good so far. I'm really, really enjoying it. Soundtrack's great. I do love a good remix of John Williams' Lost in Space theme. I've got the album on Spotify. I've been listening to it, and it's really good. The kids aren't annoying.
Yeah.
They're really good. They're really capable, but they're not smart know-it-alls. But they're believable that this is a family that's been chosen to colonize a new world. So they have to be fairly smart. They're not going to send idiots out there. Mm. Everyone's really great, and it's fun. It's not too dark. People aren't getting killed all the time. It's a family show. Star Trek Discovery was great fun, but you know, it had themes in it that probably aren't suitable for young children. I think Lost in Space walks that line really well, which is surprising considering the director behind the first two episodes and one of the executive producers is Neil Marshall, who's a British director who directed films like Dog Soldiers, The Descent, Doomsday, and Centurion, and directed some of the biggest battle episodes of Game of Thrones, and also produced the pirate show Black Sails.
Oh.
He was behind a lot of that, I think he directed. So this man, normally, it's yeah. heads flying everywhere, limbs getting lopped off,
yeah.
werewolves ripping apart squaddies,
yeah.
chicks with picks battling underground
yeah.
monsters. But here it's just kind of like all paired back. He's got an eye for the action, but this is just really good fun.
Yeah. We do get a disembodied robot and someone trapped in ice for an awfully long time. But
it's mild peril. If a film certificate screen was coming up, it would say scenes of intense peril, but that's about it. It's fine. It's suitable for all ages, I'd say.
Let's talk to Professor Ethan Siegel.
Ethan, have you been watching?
I have seen the first episode. I watched the pilot on Netflix, and interestingly enough, the very first con I was at, the first science fiction fantasy convention I was at, I was a science guest of honor there, and Marta Kristen and Mark Goddard, who were the original Robinson parents, the two of the original Robinsons on the original 1960s Lost in Space, were also guests of honor. They were media guests of honor at that, so I had a chance to meet them and talk with them a little bit. And it was really interesting to learn how much Mark Goddard, even 50 years later, hated that robot. He just hated that robot so much. Just wishes he would have thrown the robot off the ship every time. Yeah. And so it's interesting to see the latest version, because for me, the reboot, you know, I always shudder to say, let's compare it to the original, because that's never a fair thing to do. So how does it stand on its own as a show? And honestly, at least after the pilot, the first thing it reminded me of was like a family-friendly version of the show The 100.
Okay, yeah.
That I just felt like, wow, this is really a story about survival amidst a harsh environment where you face unknown dangers, but you know that things are dangerous. You know, other than that, the other thing that I think it most reminded me of for the way the kids were characterized is it reminded me a lot of Jurassic Park. Because Jurassic Park is really the only other science fiction fantasy type, you know, thing I can think of where kids of all ages, including young kids, are viewed as talented and competent and trusted, and that's what the kids in the show are. I think if you're looking for a family-friendly type of show where the kids are active, fully formed participants, like I think my only complaint about them is that they seem too much like adults and not enough like kids with the flaws of kids. But I'm pleased to see that it isn't just, oh, Will Robinson is the one who's talented and all the other daughters are nothing. Like, no, all of the Robinson kids in this show seem to be fully fleshed out characters with talents and competencies and issues that they have to face. I also felt, though, that it was really just, at least in the first episode, and maybe it changes as it goes on, because it is on Netflix and you can just binge the whole thing, is I really thought, you know, it seems like they just go from one disaster to another disaster to another disaster to another disaster, and this is just interspersed with flashbacks that are supposed to tell us who these characters actually are. It may get better, but I sort of view this as this is much more of an action, this is the problem we have to overcome, this is the obstacle we have to face, rather than like a character drama where you learn a lot about the characters and you become invested in them and you really care about what happens to them from one episode to the next. I just have a hunch, because of the family-friendly nature of Lost in Space, that these kids aren't ever really in danger of dying, that I really don't see that, yeah, we're just going to kill one of these Robinson kids off. I don't see that happening.
Yeah, it's not that type of show, but you're kind of on the
but
right.
But that's my first impression of the new Lost in Space.
I'm really enjoying it. Me and my wife are really on board because, like you said, it is really fun and family-friendly, and the kids seem competent and really fun rather than annoying. And past episode one, they do have their flaws and they do have their things that set them back, which makes it good. They're not like child proteges and they're not all geniuses. And you find out that, you know, maybe one of them wasn't meant to be there in the first place and someone pulled strings to get them there. So it is really good. And unlike the original series where they're the perfect family unit, this family isn't like that. So while they're all experts in their individual fields, because if you're going to colonize a new world, you want the best and the brightest, they're not perfect. And that's kind of why I'm really enjoying it. And it is fun. It's good fun.
I've only seen one, and I took the decision at the end of the first one that I was just going to watch one a week. It felt like a one a week kind of thing. It didn't. I think because of what you say about it's just one disaster to the next, I feel like that would become very tiresome if I was binge watching it. But I can do that. I can do that once a week. If I'm also watching people die every episode in something else, then, you know, I'm not looking for that to happen in this, and that's okay with me.
That's true. I mean, Westworld season 2 is about to start, I think people are going to be dying every week in that. So.
But, yeah, the first season of that was really delightful, and so I enjoyed Westworld thoroughly. And yeah, if I brought up the 100, that is, they don't stay at 100 for very long. Spoiler, if you haven't seen that.
Fair enough. Did you enjoy the original series?
The original series, I'm definitely young enough that the original series I only saw much later than when it first aired. And so for me, to ask me if I enjoyed the original series, well, yeah, I did. But I enjoyed it in sort of the same way I enjoyed, like, Gilligan's Island, where it was like, you know, this is extremely light fare, where the challenges that everyone faces are, you know, these are relatively unimportant challenges. It's not like they're facing things like, oh my God, we're going to run out of air and all like die of suffocation in space. It's not like Lost in Space, the original, is not like watching Apollo 13, for example, which, you know, is fine. But honestly, I think that Lost in Space, it was really like its own standalone thing. And for me, just to compare like Lost in Space with Star Trek, which were, you know, relatively contemporaneous, I felt like what Star Trek was sort of offering was the opposite vision of Lost in Space. That Lost in Space was really about these fears of how we're going to ruin Earth, and then we're not even going to be able to successfully, like, go off of Earth to, like, give humanity a chance. That it was those levels of fear. Whereas for Star Trek, it was really sort of the polar opposite of, let's imagine hundreds of years in the future that we've used science and technology to solve these great problems facing us on Earth today, and that we are out among the stars, but it's on a mission of peace and exploration, not on a mission to, you know, give humanity a second chance on this other place because we ruined the first place. And so I think the premise of Lost in Space I found less appealing than the premise of a more optimistic and altruistic show like Star Trek.
I did notice in the new series that, from what I remember in the original series, it was nations competing with each other to colonize a new world, and that's why Dr. Smith sabotaged the Jupiter 2 and got caught up. But in the new series, it's because essentially Earth was hit by an asteroid, which they call the Christmas Star in the first episode. So I was like, oh, we haven't fucked it up. It's a natural disaster, which I thought was kind of a cop-out, because even in the 1998 film version, it's because we've messed the planet up. Recycling doesn't work anymore, and if humanity is going to survive, we need a new world. So I was kind of intrigued why the new series didn't go that way, unless they thought it would be too bleak for families. Mm. It's kind of like, oh no, nothing we do is going to save this planet, so we better make it a natural disaster for the reason why we need to move.
Yeah, that's sort of an interesting comparison. I hadn't thought of those, you know, that on the one hand, it was blamed on humanity and it was humanity's failings. And then, you know, in the new incarnation, it isn't. And that is, I suppose, a very big difference for what they're facing. I also really like the arc, and I hope they explore this more, of that the Robinson parents are in a failing marriage.
Yeah.
But they're working hard to give it another try. And it's not for the sake of the kids. They're doing it because they want to give it another try with each other. Mm-hmm. And that I think is something that that provide, you know, whenever you talk about science fiction, you have a little bit of freedom to explore things that people are uncomfortable with in, you know, present day fiction, that something can hit too close to home. And so I'm curious if they're going to explore any of the issues that, you know, that couples in a difficult marriage face, trying to work that out and trying to work through those issues and trying to work through past hurts, that maybe that lens of science fiction over it and this setting in the future will allow them to explore. That's, you know, that's a different level of exploration than what you get in, let's say, even a brilliant show like Catastrophe, where, you know, this is set in, you know, modern day UK, and, you know, they have like, oh, like he's gone and slipped back into his alcoholism, and she goes out and gets drunk and blacks out and sees this guy, and then you don't know what happens. And then you find out what happens, and it was nothing. It would be interesting if you could explore what happens when the answer isn't the cop-out answer of nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and I, again, family-friendly, so I don't know how much down that road you can go, or they will go, but I'm curious to know if they explore that at all too, because that's, you know, like I said, when you have that extra veneer of, oh, this isn't reality, this is something that may yet come to pass, that I feel gives you a little bit of extra freedom. And again, that's something that I think Star Trek explores extremely well.
From what I've seen from the first three episodes, that parental dynamic is really pushed and shown to be under pressure. And it's a really interesting part of the story. And I've also liked something that, from what I've seen so far, isn't referenced specifically, but the fact that all the Robinson children appear to be adopted, which is just something that I was like, yeah, no, that's good, because I like the fact that Judy isn't white. It's like, because the original series, they couldn't be more cookie-cut white suburban family. I'm surprised there's not a white picket fence around Jupiter 2 in the original series half the time. But that it's just another little thing that, as someone, you know, who is of a minority, it's good to see a little bit of diversity sprinkled in there. And I had seen online that it has perplexed some people, and, you know, some people are asking it to be specifically spelt out, and it might be later in the series, but three episodes in, they're just like, no, we're not addressing it.
Yeah.
Figure it out yourself.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, and I think that's a totally good decision, too, because if you want to normalize something, the best way to normalize it is to just treat it like this is normal. Like, this doesn't need to be specially addressed, to just behave as though, yeah, this is the way things are. I mean, you know, I had the chance to talk with DC Fontana a couple of months ago, who was a very famous writer of many original series Star Trek episodes. And what she told me was, just by virtue of having Uhura on the bridge, having a main character on the show be black, there were entire states that would not air Star Trek when it first aired, that they just would not air the first season. And they asked Gene Roddenberry what he wanted to do, and he said, let them go. Let them not air it. And NBC or CBS, whichever network it was, probably CBS, backed him and said, okay, they won't air it, and they'll air something else. And they said, fine. And then after it was a relative success the first season, and they brought it back for a second season, they said, okay, we want this show after all. Mm. And they said to Gene again, what do you want to do? And he said, let him have it. That's it. Like, there's no vengeance here. This is normal. This is something that everyone should be exposed to. And there it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you watch it,
and so I think that same strategy of just, no, this is normal, and we're going to treat it as normal, and we're going to make the audience reckon with it as this is the normal, is a very outstanding strategy for affecting social change like that.
Yeah.
There was a great episode of Drunk History recently on Comedy Central that dealt with Nichelle Nichols and her boundary-breaking performance in Star Trek. So if you haven't seen that, that's worth checking out.
Oh, I watched Drunk History, hilarious. But I haven't been watching the latest season, so I will...
I think it's like the third episode of the new season, and it's great.
One of the things that I remember about watching Lost in Space as a kid was me and my brother basically used to watch it because it was kind of awful. And the robot was so awful, and Dr. Smith was so, camp and,
yeah,
and just fake, basically. And we just used to watch it, partly because it was science fiction and it was fun, and partly because it was ridiculous and it was fun. But, weirdly, the nostalgia and kind of, I guess it's almost, I almost loved it because of the nostalgia, and I think it was nicely done, of the robot in this incarnation of Lost in Space meeting up with Will Robinson was just really, really brilliantly done. And what did you make of the robot?
I actually liked the robot a lot. I mean, I was curious how they were going to basically turn, cardboard box with vacuum tubes into modern day like robot. And of course, like, the visuals are much better. But when the robot said "Danger, Will Robinson," it didn't feel forced at all, because that was what I was expecting, is, oh God, they're just going to shoehorn this in there. And they didn't. It felt like it developed very naturally with Will and the robot in the dangerous situations that they had found themselves in. And now it's the robot's time to give the warning about what is coming and what is here. And it felt very much like this robot is almost like an alien more than a robot. Like, this is something to be curious about and figure out and try and understand and try to communicate with and try to, figure out figure out what it needs and for it to figure out what you need. Like, it was almost more of a let's figure out how to collaborate situation than it was something that was obviously just a campy sort of device for, like, toy thing for the kids to play with is how I felt about it. How did you feel about it?
Totally, yeah. I think brilliantly done. Really, yeah. I got goose pimples. It worked for me. And because I saw the posters and I thought, well, that's clearly the robot. And the posters, I don't know what it's like in America, but here the posters are literally everywhere.
Oh, they're everywhere, yeah. They've absolutely really gone hard on the everywhere. Advertising.
And just finally on that, actually, Will Robinson, I was fully expecting to find him as irritating as possible, but no, he's doing
really good. He is really good, that kid.
Yeah.
I've been really impressed with him. In fact, one thing I did notice in the first episode is the man that the new Dr. Smith takes the jacket off at the end.
The Parker Posey, yeah.
Parker Posey.
I'm of course, like, I don't know. I think anyone between the ages of about 35 and 50 or so is going to be very pleased to see Parker Posey.
She's
in this.
Really good in it. She's very good.
Like,
The man who, the jacket she takes off, that's William Mummy, who played the original Will Robinson in it. So it's just like that little thing. Oh. If you knew who it was, you're like, yeah, I like that.
That's awesome. I didn't know that.
He also appeared in an episode of Deep Space Nine in the last series.
Did he?
Yeah, as a Starfleet engineer who then gets brutally killed.
Yeah. But, you see, apart from general brilliance, is why Ty is on the podcast. Right? So
that is a fun Easter egg to identify. Well done.
Yeah. Okay, so Will Robinson says that he is the first human to make contact with an alien civilization, right? We are trying to make contact with an alien civilization through METI and SETI.
Yes, yes, yes.
And there is something called the Drake Equation, which we have spoken about on the podcast before, but you wrote an article recently for your blog on Forbes.
Yes, yes, I did. I wrote an article for Starts with a Bang where I talked about, you know, when we think about the Drake Equation, it was sort of a wonderful way of, I think the way I'd describe it is, of parametrizing our ignorance.
Good word.
We know at the time, you know, the Drake Equation is almost 60 years old, which is crazy to think that this line of thought about trying to estimate how many alien civilizations are there is both that old and also only that young. But we didn't know a whole lot of things at that time. We didn't know if stars beyond our sun had planets orbiting them or not. We didn't know how rare they were. We didn't know what they'd be made out of, whether rocky planets would be common or rare, whether planets with atmospheres or not would be common or rare, whether planets that orbited at the right distance to have liquid water would be common or rare. We didn't even really know how many stars there were in the galaxy or how many galaxies there were in the universe. And so when we started asking this, Frank Drake's original way to do it was to say, well, let's imagine that you form stars, right? What's the average star formation rate of the universe? And he asked that because that made more sense to him than asking how many stars are in the universe. The reason is, he said, well, star formation rate, because he assumed the universe was infinitely old. The Big Bang was not even the accepted theory of the origin of the universe when Drake formulated his equation. So he was not working under that same framework. He said, okay, then you form stars. What fraction of stars form planets? Well, we know the answer now is probably about 100%. Yeah. That it's pretty impossible to form stars without planets. And that comes from simulations and observations. Wherever we've been able to adequately measure, does a star have planets around it? The answer is yes. And based on the inferences we've made from, like, NASA Kepler, where you have the transits, where you have a planet passing in front of a star and the probability of that in orientations, we do. We think it's around 100%, you know, maybe as low as like 80%, but that's still like 100% when we're talking about order of magnitude estimates. Many said, okay, how many of these planets have, you know, how many of these stars with planets have a planet where life could potentially arise? Now, when Carl Sagan is how I became aware of the Drake equation, because he did a whole large episode section on it in his original Cosmos. When Carl Sagan did this, he went through the Drake equation exactly as it was and would say things like, oh, if only 10% of the worlds where life could have arisen arose, and if only 10% of the places where life arose, intelligent life arise, and then if only 10% of those developed alien detecting technologies, well, look at this, there's 100,000, you know, alien species transmitting right now. And I can't help but look at that and take a listen to only 10% and say, wow, like, hello, wild optimism, and look at you couching that as being pessimistic, if only 10%. So what the Drake equation attempted to do was to get all the way from, okay, you have a star, and what are the odds that you're going to have, at the end, an alien species like us? It also made the assumption that if you're an alien species, of course, the only way you're going to make communications is through radio, that you're going to transmit in the radio and you're going to listen in the radio. And I would be surprised if by the end of this century, may we all live to see it, if by the end of this century, human beings are still using radio for pretty much anything.
Yeah.
They'll be
using podcasts, right?
Well, certainly podcasts have already changed the shape of radio. We are transmitting far less radio signals and power overall than we were a generation ago, because this is not the means that people communicate with anymore. It's less efficient, it's more wasteful, it's noisy and polluty, and it's not the way we do things. So when Drake made these estimates, he was assuming steady-state model of the universe, we know nothing about planets around other stars, and also aliens will attempt to communicate with radio signals, and that's what we need to look for. And so I think that idea, the basic idea of, given the things we know about the universe, what can we expect is going to be out there in terms of alien life? Let's find a way to calculate that. And so what I proposed was just, let's make a modern version of this. We know how many stars are in the galaxy, and we know how many galaxies are in the universe. We know what fraction of planets have stars. We know what fraction of stars with planets have planets in the potentially habitable zone. And we know of those planets, how many of them, what percent of them have the right ingredients and conditions that life could arise. Then there's three big unknown steps. And these are still unknowns, and I blame this on biology, because biology is hard. Astronomy, astrophysics, this is easy. This is why I do it, because it's something where you just point your telescopes with the right technology out at the universe, you get the answer. Because you have so much universe to look at. Biology is a lot harder. You say, okay, how did life arise from non-life? You know, we assume that it did, and I'm just going to assume that. I know people, some of your listeners maybe have other explanations, but I'm just going to assume that life arose from non-life naturally. And so you're asking, what are the odds that this would happen? And we don't know, because we've never done it. We've never said, hey, let's take this non-life, let's, you know, put it in a petri dish or whatever, and let's make life. We'd love to do that, but we haven't. So we can look at all the circumstantial evidence. We can say, well, let's look at the fossil record on Earth, and let's go all the way back to the earliest deposits that we have. And we have carbon signature deposits that are indicators of life in these ancient crystals over 4 billion years ago, and the ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12 in them, not carbon-14, carbon-13, different isotope, tells you, okay, was this life, was this having a biological process, and when did this biological process stop? And so the, from the carbon-13 to carbon-12 ratios, we can say, yep, there was likely life in this thing that made this fossil deposit 4.1 billion years ago. Earth is only 4.5 billion years old, so we believe that if Earth wasn't born with life on it, life arose on Earth really fast. If we look out at space, we see all the ingredients for life everywhere. We see outflows of organic molecules around young, heavy stars. We see amino acids and sugars and cyanide molecules and benzene rings and even ethyl formate, which is the molecule that gives raspberries its smell, in interstellar space. We can cut into the meteorites that fall on Earth, like the Murchison meteorite, which landed in Australia, I believe, in the 60s. And when we cut into that meteorite and we say, hey, what's in there? The answer is, oh, guess what? There's amino acids in there. Are there the 20 amino acids that are involved in all life processes on Earth? Yes. And also more than 60 other unique ones, including amino acids with the opposite chirality, with the opposite handedness to them. All of the amino acids involved in life processes on Earth have a single chirality. And we find meteorites with amino acids that have ones with the opposite chirality. So this tells me the ingredients for life are literally everywhere. And the ingredients for life, not as we know it, but that takes a different chemical pathway, are also everywhere. So there may be something special about us, but it may also be that the conditions and ingredients are everywhere, and so it's very likely that life arose in other places. That's the first big unknown, is given the right ingredients, how likely are you to have life? We know it doesn't happen all the time, because Venus isn't teeming with life, and Mars isn't teeming with life, and as far as we can tell, Europa and Enceladus and Titan and Pluto and all these other worlds with either liquid water or some other liquid ocean or clouds, like these other theoretically hospitable environments, don't seem to have actual life. Maybe Mars did in the past. Maybe it still does today in some forms. Maybe there's microbial life in places. And for me, microbial life is still life. I'm excited about the upcoming set of planet hunting and planet finding missions, because one of the big holy grails that they're going to look for is, I told you about this transit method where you have a star and you measure a planet because the planet passes in front of that star. So whenever the planet passes in front of the star, it blocks some of the light. You measure a dip in the flux, and then it rises again. Well, if you make a sensitive enough detector, then when that planet passes in front of the star, that starlight is going to filter through the atmosphere of the planet. And whatever is present in the atmosphere is going to absorb a little bit of that starlight. If you get something like an atmosphere that contains a lot of molecular oxygen, more than about 5%, that's a smoking gun for life, because molecular oxygen doesn't form in large abundances anywhere else in the universe that we know of. So if you see a planet with the right atmospheric signatures, you can say, you know what, I bet there's life in there. If you see oxygen in the presence of a gas like nitrogen and with water vapor and traces of like methane and carbon dioxide, it'd be crazy to think that world didn't have life. So that's a question I hope we're able to start coming up with an answer to with the next generation of space telescopes.
Well, TESS has just got up, right?
TESS, yeah, today.
Yeah.
Today. It should launch, actually, if I remember right, it should launch in 3 hours.
Okay.
So it's scheduled for launch later today. By time your listeners hear this, yeah, TESS will have launched, we hope, unless it gets scrubbed again for weather. Because of the weird orbit TESS is going into, where it's going out near the moon and coming back, it only has a launch window, I think, for a short window every month. So if we can't launch it today, we may have to wait for the next lunar cycle to get there. Okay. But I'm hoping it launches, because TESS is, in many ways, the successor to NASA's Kepler. And while TESS itself won't be measuring the exo-atmospheres of these worlds, it will be looking for worlds that should be excellent targets for exo-atmosphere imaging. So it will identify, you know, when Kepler went up, it was mostly identifying, hey, let's look at this one region of sky that's pointing towards the spiral arm of Orion. So we can see like 150,000 stars at once and see how many of them have planets. Well, now TESS is going to be dedicated like, hey, this star 13 light years away looks promising. Hey, this one 40 light years away looks promising. So by getting the close by stars and looking for transiting planets around them, it's going to have the opportunity to identify these real potential, like, hey, here's an Earth-sized world around a star where we could see the atmosphere with the telescopes that come after it. Ideally, James Webb Space Telescope, or possibly some of the 30-meter class ground-based telescopes, like the Giant Magellan Telescope, the ELT, or if they can ever figure out a site for it, the 30-meter telescope. Those will have the potential as well to measure those exo-atmospheres.
Awesome stuff. Back to Lost in Space slightly. So I'm very pleased that Lost in Space exists as a family-friendly science fiction series, because there isn't anything that people don't die all the time in. You know, everything is just constantly death, 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 death. And my daughter, Lyra, is a very sensitive little person, six years old, and she cried a lot in Paddington 2 because Paddington went to prison for something he didn't do.
Oh.
Right. So the concept of people dying in space is not something I want to put to it too often, okay?
No, but good for you. That's good parenting work.
Yeah,
you parents know what will traumatize your child, and you steer away from that.
Yeah.
So yeah. Kudos.
But I feel like Star Trek and, you know, those sorts of things are a long way off from where she is right now. But Lost in Space feels like it might bridge a gap, which in a few years we might be able to go to. But Lyra asked me a question the other day, and I thought, I'm speaking to Ethan, I'm going to put it to you instead, okay? And
okay.
Her question was, we were just talking about lemurs, right, in the car. We were talking about lemurs, and she said, she went quiet for a bit, and she said, Daddy, I'm a bit confused. I understand that the Big Bang made everything, and it made the stars, and it made space. But where did the Big Bang happen if there was no space for the Big Bang to happen in?
Oh, that's a good question. And it's a good question because it tells us, oh, we must have oversimplified somewhere. So we did. And I'll tell you, as it was originally thought of, or for her, it was originally thought of that we said, well, here's the thing. We see space today, and it's expanding. And so if you see something today that's expanding, then you want to ask, well, what was it doing earlier? And the answer is, well, it must have been expanding also, so it was smaller in the past. And so you can go back and say smaller, smaller, smaller. What happens if we go all the way back to where it's all condensed into a single point? Well, in physics, we call that a singularity. In mathematics, too, we call this a singularity. It's if you imagine going all the way back to a single point. And if you imagine taking everything in the universe and compressing it into a single point, what would that point look like? There would be so much energy in there, so much mass in there. All the planets and the stars and the galaxies and everything, imagine in just a little tiny point. That's what a singularity would be. Now, our laws of physics, our laws of everything as we know them, they break down at a singularity. Any calculations you can do, they don't make sense. The temperatures are too high, the energies are too high. Whatever you try to calculate doesn't work out. So what we say where everything breaks down is this singularity is where space and time could be born. But when we look at our actual universe, we say, well, let me make extrapolations back. So I can say, well, I can go back to a point where gravity hadn't pulled all the matter into stars and galaxies, so I should see a point where there are no stars and galaxies, and we do. And then you say, well, if it was smaller in the past, and this is maybe a little advanced for her, but if it was smaller in the past, light is a form of radiation, and radiation is defined by its wavelength. Long wavelength radiation has low energy. Short wavelength radiation has high energy. So if I take my universe with radiation in it, and I'm looking back in time to the past, then that radiation was shorter and shorter and shorter. And at some point, its wavelength was so small, its energy was so high, that you couldn't even make neutral atoms. If you have an atom and high energy radiation, that radiation is going to kick the electron off of the proton, and you can't make atoms anymore. So you can say, wow, well, I should see a time early on where I don't even have neutral atoms, and we do. And you can go back and say, well, what if you don't even have atomic nuclei, and we see that? And you can say, well, what if we go all the way back to when it was so energetic that you would blast protons apart, and we see that? But then you can say, well, I want to go all the way back to a singularity. What would I get as I went back and back and back along that path? And at some point, shortly before you get to the singularity, the signatures you predict to be there aren't there. They don't show up. It tells you that the universe didn't start from a singularity with this naive extrapolation. Instead, something else had to happen before that. What set up what we call the Big Bang? That's a whole other theory. It was first put forth in the late 70s, early 80s, and it's called cosmic inflation. And that is our theory of where the universe came from. That's our theory of what happened before the Big Bang. So there was some space, but it was inflating. And what inflating means is it expanded exponentially. So here's what exponential means, and let's see if I can do this for a six-year-old. Exponential, right, when you're used to things expanding or getting bigger, you'll say like, oh, well, maybe they'll get better like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? They get bigger like that. Or maybe they'll get bigger, you know, steeper, right? Maybe they'll go like 1, like 2, 4, 6, 8, right? Or maybe they'll go even steeper, where it'll be like, okay, 1 and 4 and 9 and 16, like maybe you'll take a path that curves up speedily. Exponential goes even faster than all of those. Exponential says after a certain amount of time goes by, everything gets doubled. So if my universe was a size of 1, 1, 1 in all dimensions, then after a certain amount of time goes by, now it's 2, 2, 2. So it doubled. Then that same amount of time goes by and it goes 4, 4, 4. Then that same amount of time goes by and it goes 8, 8, 8, and so on. And it doubles and doubles and doubles and doubles. This is very fast. If I said it takes 1 second for the universe to double in size, then after about 100 seconds, the universe would be 10 to the 30 times, a one with 30 zeros after it, the size it is. After 1,000 seconds, which is really still only about 15 to 20 minutes, your universe is 10 to the 300 times the size. That's enough that if you took what we would call a singularity and say, hey, that point that's so small that I can barely like make math work at this scale, I'm going to let it expand for this, you know, 1,000 doublings like that, it would be far larger than the entire observable universe today. So what inflation does is it takes whatever small region of space starts inflating, stretches it super large, and then inflation comes to an end. So where does the Big Bang occur? Well, when inflation ends, that turns all of that energy that was making space inflate, and it turns it into matter and radiation. That's what we call the hot Big Bang, to when the universe isn't just expanding, but it's full of all the stuff that makes our universe the interesting place it is. So inflation is what comes before the Big Bang. This expanding space is what existed first. Then inflation ends, and you have the hot Big Bang. And where do you have it? You have it everywhere all at once. And we're part of that, but we're not the only place.
How do you mean?
Well, go 40 billion light years away to a distant galaxy. They had the Big Bang happen there, too. Go maybe 100 billion light years away to past where we can see in the observable universe. They probably had a Big Bang happen out there, too. As far as we can see, the universe is far, far bigger than what we can see. The part of it we can see is only visible to us because light has had enough time since the Big Bang to reach our eyes. But because the universe had a birthday, because it had a day without a yesterday, right? The universe was born when inflation ended and the Big Bang happened. That happened at a certain point in time. We can only see what light has had at the speed of light a chance to reach us by today. So every day that goes on, there's more and more distant light that can finally reach us.
Awesome. Listen, Ethan, I want to ask you, and I'm not going to let you answer this, right? But I want to ask you why time goes forwards. Don't answer it. But if people want to know why time goes forwards, they can go to your blog, right?
They sure can. My blog, if you want to know, is forbes.com/sites/starts-with-a-bang. I do talk about all sorts of things like why does time only go forward, how was our universe born, what happened before the Big Bang. Once a week, I run a feature called Ask Ethan. So if you want your questions answered by me, send me an email at startswithabang@gmail.com, and I'll consider your questions for Ask Ethan. If I don't get back to you, it's because I didn't pick it, because I get a lot of these. If I answered every email I get, it would be all I did, and I would never finish doing it.
Yeah. Well, listen, time has moved forward. Ty, do you have any questions for Ethan?
I was going to ask about how the Fermi paradox enters into his newfound thoughts about the Drake equation.
Yeah, I mean, the Fermi paradox, to boil it down, for those who aren't familiar, says, if life is common in the universe, then where is everybody? And I think the obvious answer to that is what we think of as intelligent, spacefaring, communicative aliens are clearly not common. They're clearly not common in our galaxy. And so if you're asking where is everybody, the answer is not close by and easily detectable. That's probably the resolution to the Fermi paradox. A lot of people say, well, what about the great filter? Well, what about, right? Yeah, you can invent all sorts of other explanations. But the simplest one is that if part of the statement, if intelligent life is common in the universe, is probably not true. So that's my simple answer, brief answer to the Fermi paradox.
Yeah.
Or they're smart enough to stay away.
Yeah. Let's not get into that. Are you going to carry on watching Lost in Space?
I'm not sure. It depends on if I can get my wife on board or not. We have a bunch of... I think it's wonderful that we live in a time where there is so much excellent television happening. I may or may not continue to watch Lost in Space. We haven't reached a decision on that yet. But regardless, I hope that everyone who does continue to watch whatever series they're watching enjoys them all. And I will definitely be tuning into Discovery Season 2 and have watched all of Season 1.
Okay.
So don't doubt that.
Are you excited about Season 2?
I am excited about Season 2. You know, I will give you a little bit of a spoiler for Season 1. If you had asked me if I was going to be excited about Season 2 after the first 6 episodes of Star Trek Discovery, I would have said, boy, I really don't know. the seventh episode, for those of you who haven't watched it because you were disappointed in the first episode or two, the seventh episode, I was all prepared to hate on it. I assume you have that expression where you are, to hate on something. Yeah, so I was all prepared to hate on this episode, and I just found myself really enjoying it in a whole bunch of different times. Like, wow, I really like that. I really like that. I really like that. Damn, I got to the end of the episode. This was just a great science fiction episode. Then
was that the time episode loop one?
8 and 9? Say that again?
Was that the time loop one? That's it, right. Was, yeah. That was great. Yeah.
That was so solid. I was like blown away. I was like, this episode showed me the potential of this show, and I want to see more of it. And then with the whole Mirror Universe arc that they had, I thought that was phenomenal. When they came back from mid-season hiatus and they're in the Mirror Universe, and I know the first episode back was directed by Jonathan Frakes, and it was fantastic. I was like, you know, there are a whole lot of great things about this episode and subsequent episodes that I wanted to find out more. I may have had some issues with the finale of the season finale, the series yeah. finale of Star Trek Discovery. I don't think I really got on board with the message of, oh yeah, Klingons don't negotiate with terrorists unless the terrorist is also a Klingon, in which case, like, that's just going to solve all your problems.
And if you put a bomb in the center of their planet, then they'll just retreat.
Yeah, I didn't really... That gave me the message that nonviolence in the face of an adversary who will just kill you is an acceptable strategy. And I can't really get on board with that message. And so that was something that I felt a very strong gut reaction against. And I guess in Star Trek, it's possible that Burnham and Starfleet knew something about Klingons that they never shared with us, that this would be a reasonable way for them to react. Mm. But I didn't buy it.
It'll be interesting to see what season 2 brings, considering how season 1 ended, without wanting to spoil anything for anyone, but the fact that they've just cast Anson Mount as an original series character. Pike. And he looks just like Jeffrey Hunter. Yeah. It'll be fascinating to see what happens in season 2.
Yeah, and look, I think season 2, I think if you look at any first season of any of the Star Treks, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, original series, even Enterprise, there were a lot of misses in the first season of any Star Trek incarnation. Yeah. And so if you look at Discovery, and in a 15-episode series, if you look at, wow, they had how many good episodes in there? How many hits did they have there? How many, like, and you say, wow, like, it's actually substantial. They had a large number of very good episodes in there. I think there are many, many good reasons to be excited about what could happen in season 2. I don't think it's a guarantee that season 2 is going to be killer, but I want to see it, and I've got hope for it, and that's a big deal.
Oh yeah, compared to Next Gen, DS9, Voyager, and Enterprise, Discovery's batting average for the first season was up there, because let's face it, their first series of all those shows are dodgy as hell. There are some awful episodes, especially Next Gen.
Oh yeah, and I know I'm super guilty of this. Like, I happily tell people that my favorite series is Next Generation, and when they ask me, like, what are my favorite episodes, I will
start from season 3.
With one exception, all of my episodes are season 3 and later.
Yeah.
There's only one episode. You got it.
Yeah.
You got it.
It's the only good Measure one. Man. Everything else Best. Is a bit rubbish.
Yeah, super good. Yeah. Super good. But yeah, that's my favorite. If you make it to the section on androids in my book Treknology, you will see Measure of a Man heavily referenced in there.
Yeah. awesome stuff. Listen, we've had you for an hour, so we should let you go.
Time went by really fast, didn't it?
It did. In one direction, weirdly. But thank you so much for talking to us again. And listen, let's talk again when season two has happened of Discovery.
Or when it's about to kick off. Yeah. We can predict what we think's going to happen.
Yeah.
Oh, that'll be fun. That'll be fun if we can have a how psychic can we be.
Yeah.
This August, I'll be at Star Trek Las Vegas. So I am going to try and get as much information about what's coming up as I can.
Jason Isaacs is
going
to be there.
If you want to interview Jason Isaacs, and then we'll put that out as a Cosmic Shed podcast, that's fine.
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
I'll try. It makes me so curious about what really happened to Prime Universe Lorca. Aren't you a little curious about Prime Lorca?
Oh, yeah. They said no one from our universe could have ever survived there for so long, which basically means we're not going to tell you what happened. He'll be back at some point, probably season 3, as like a one-eyed Captain Lorca who's incredibly damaged. Like a Captain Ahab. This is what I'm thinking. This is where my mind's going.
Okay.
Is this like the Riker from the parallel universe where the Borg went crazy?
Yeah, just
that
a big bushy beard.
Lorca's life, just a terrible beard, disheveled. And
awesome.
I want to see that too.
It sounds wonderful. I just had him as a really, really, really awesome guy. And I just want to see that.
He's really timid. And he's like, guys, please. Yeah. I live to serve.
Yeah. Yeah, I just have to say this actually. I know what you're saying about that message, but if there is a place for the message of just responding with peace to an all-out war, then Star Trek's the place for it, right?
I think it could be. You know, Star Trek. I would say that is the main message of Star Trek, is that war is not the solution and might does not make right and violence is not the answer. And yet I also look at this through the lens of what do you do when you're in a fight with someone who does not recognize your right to exist? And that, I think I'd like to see that question explored a little more in Star Trek. And maybe it's possible that they wanted to, and they just ran out of episodes and they didn't have enough time to do it. It's also possible that stuff was explained and just wound up on the cutting room floor. Yeah. So, you know, I don't think I could really know the answer to that. But I do hope that some of those questions that I had at the end of the first season do have legitimate answers, even if they're, you know, retrofitted answers to sort of go back and explain a plot hole like you do with the Kessel Run in Star Wars, to say like, oh no, it makes sense that it's 12 parsecs because the black hole and short space and whatever. Like, sure, George Lucas, sure, you didn't make a mistake. You had that all planned out. If they can go back and make a fix for that, I'd like to see it. But I do agree. I mean, the message of optimism, of peace, that there are solutions, that we can find common ground, and that we can, and that we don't need to just blow our enemies to smithereens to get an answer. Star Trek's definitely the place for that.
Yeah, absolutely. And humanity needs an answer to that right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think a big part of what I would like to see that I think we can all agree on is that is our ultimate goal, is for humans to go out and explore the universe, then we need to be investing as a species in that enterprise, in that endeavor, that we need to go and say, hey, we need to learn what's out there, what's worth investigating, and we need to invest in, you know, heavy launch vehicles that could send humans out to these great distances. You don't take one miracle leap, you know. We may never get visited by Vulcans who just give us all this great technology. That may never happen. And assuming it doesn't, it's on us.
We wouldn't accept it anyway. There's no way humanity would accept it. It would be like a V situation where we just think they're giant lizard people trying to trick us with their awesome technology.
Or a rival as well. That,
So you think we'd be more like the fundamentalist bomber from Contact?
Yes, I think that's exactly the majority.
Oh no, you guys are trying to build this alien technology, and don't you see it's just a doomsday device? Let me blow it up. What do you people want?
Oh, you've come here with your medical technology that will cure cancer. You just want to eat us all. That's what I think the majority of humanity would go to, unfortunately.
Well, you got
to
watch more Star Trek and less Twilight Zone. Or less Black Mirror.
Tell Ty to watch more Star Trek. That's not possible.
No, it's what I do. This interview is interrupting my Star Trek watching time.
Right, okay, listen, thank you so much for talking to us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me back on, and we'll absolutely do it again when we get close to Discovery Season 2.
Awesome. Thanks, Ethan.
Cheers. Oh, no, hang on. Tell us about your cruise.
Oh, geez. So this is actually extra nice for those of you who are in, or in the case of the UK, close to the European Union, because January of next year, I'm going to be leading an astro tour of Iceland. So, you can either pay for an all-inclusive transatlantic flight, or you can get your own flight if you're not from the US, and just meet us in Reykjavik, and we will go on a six-day tour of Iceland in the winter, where we will get 16 hours of darkness a night, and we will go hunting for Aurora. During the day, we will go to glaciers and lagoons and volcanoes and all the geological sites. You will have access to me. I will be there leading the tour. And one of the nights that we're there, we're actually going to get a total lunar eclipse as just part of this. Very, very cooperative of nature to help us with that one. That there will be a total lunar eclipse a little bit before sunrise, and then we'll get sunrise. But the big spectacular show, we hope, are going to be the aurorae. Iceland is up very far north, as most of you know, and that means spectacular views of the aurora whenever skies are clear. And in January, it might not be every night, but we're very optimistic that we will get some outstanding views of the Northern Lights. So if you'd like to sign up, astrotours.co/startswithabang. And that's my astro tour next January. Slots are filling up, but we still have some open, so I'd love to see you there.
Sounds awesome.
Iceland's great.
I'm going to see if I can save up and go.
All right. Cheers, great Ethan. Seeing you, and hope to talk to you again real soon.
Cheers. Bye.
See you, Ethan.
Bye, everyone.
I think what we should also do is try and get an interview with a man inside the robot suit, because it's a suit. It's not CGI. And this guy has been like a predator in the film Predators. He's been Bigfoot. He was Harry in the TV series of Harry and the Hendersons.
Was he?
We need to track this man.
We do. Let's get him.
He's massive.
Let's get him. And I would say, I watched a film on a train today on my phone on Netflix called Orbiter 9. Thoroughly enjoyed it, actually.
Really?
It's lurking there on Netflix. I would say if you're thinking of watching Passengers, don't watch Orbiter 9.
If you're thinking of watching Passengers and you think Andy Garcia is going to have a major role in it, he's there for 10 seconds at the end. Peak Andy Garcia.
We'll be back very soon with an episode on Ready Player One. Thank you very much to Ty for joining me here.
I'll have to watch more Lost in Space.
And thank you very much for listening.
Danger, Cosmic Shed. Danger.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.